Chapter 6, Seeking Salvation. Anger, dread, frustration, fear, desperation. That was the spectrum of emotions that I dealt with following Sony's death. From morning to night, each day was an intense roller coaster ride as I questioned, challenged, raged, and despaired over my situation. I felt these emotions not only for myself, but also for my family. I dreaded the thought of them having to deal with my death. My fear and desperation continued to drive me to research everything I could about holistic health and well-being, including Eastern healing systems. I was seeing several specialists in natural disciplines, and I also participated in different types of healing modalities. I tried hypnotherapy, meditated, prayed, chanted mantras, and took Chinese herbal remedies. Finally, I quit my freelance work and traveled to India to follow the healing system of Ayurveda while Danny stayed in Hong Kong. He couldn't come with me because of his job, but he visited me twice for 2 weeks each time. We also spoke on the phone almost every day because he wanted to be kept informed of how I was doing. I went to the town of Pune, where my father had passed away, to learn more about yoga and Ayurveda from one of the masters. I spent a total of 6 months in India, and during that time, I finally felt as though I were regaining my health. My yoga master put me through a grueling regimen. I had to follow a very specific diet of vegetarian food and herbal remedies, along with a routine of yoga asanas, which are poses, at sunrise and sunset. I did this for months and actually started to feel much better. He was an amazing guru who didn't even believe that I had cancer. I told him that the medical doctors had conducted tests and confirmed I had lymphoma, to which he said, "Cancer is just a word that creates fear. Forget about that word and let's just focus on balancing your body. All illnesses are just symptoms of imbalance. No illness can remain when your entire system is in balance." I really enjoyed my time under my yoga master's tutelage, and he helped alleviate my fears around cancer. At the end of 6 months, he was convinced that I was healed, and so was I. I felt victorious, as though I'd finally made the breakthrough, and I was anxious to go back home and reunite with Danny. I'd missed him terribly and had so much to share with him. When I returned home to Hong Kong, at first, many people remarked on how well I looked. I certainly felt better than I had in a long time, both physically and emotionally, but my jubilation was short-lived. It wasn't long before others wanted to know what I'd been doing for so long in India and how I'd healed. When I told them about my Ayurvedic regimen, however, I received mainly fear-based and negative responses. These were well-meaning people who genuinely cared about me and my well-being, and they were skeptical about my choices, which was why they had such a great impact on me. Most believed that cancer couldn't be treated in that way, and I slowly felt the doubts and fears creeping back into my psyche as I defended my position. In hindsight, when that began to happen, I should have gone back to India to regain my health again. Instead, I actually started to be influenced by the skepticism I was facing over my choice of treatment, so I remained in Hong Kong. I attempted to understand traditional Chinese medicine, also known as TCM, since it's commonly practiced here. However, because it conflicted so much with Ayurveda, I was left feeling very confused. In Ayurveda, you're encouraged to be vegetarian, whereas in TCM, you're encouraged to consume meat, particularly pork. In the Indian system, meats such as pork and beef are the worst things you can eat. To make matters worse, I turned to Western naturopathy for help because I was so bewildered. This not only added to the confusion, but also increased my fears. I was getting conflicting messages from every discipline. In Western naturopathic systems, sugar and dairy are considered absolute no-nos. In fact, they're seen as foods that feed the growth of cancer cells. According to the systems I was researching, sugar feeds the mutated cells. In Ayurveda, however, Dairy is a must, and sugar and sweet foods are required as part of a balanced diet based on balancing all the different taste buds. So I became very stressed about food and was afraid of eating almost anything. I didn't know what was good for me and what wasn't, because each system of healing espoused a different truth, and they all conflicted with each other. This confusion only added to my already overwhelming fears, and as the terror tightly gripped me in its vice once more, I watched helplessly as my health rapidly deteriorated. I felt the need to be alone most of the time and only let the closest to me into my life. I wanted to shut out reality in an attempt to shut out the truth. I couldn't bear how people looked at me and treated me. As my health declined, I didn't like the way others felt sorry for me and made allowances for me, as though I were different or not normal. I also felt very uncomfortable about the way those from my culture thought it was my karma, that I must have done something in a previous life to warrant this punishment. Because I too believed in karma, it made me feel as though I'd done something to be ashamed of in order to deserve this. It seemed as if I were being judged, and it also made me feel helpless. If this is retribution for something I did in a previous life, I wondered, how can I change it? What can I possibly do about it now? Thoughts like this would leave me feeling completely hopeless about my situation. But through all this, I put up a front. I laughed and smiled and made small talk, even when I didn't want to, because it was important to me not to cause concern or worry anyone else with my condition. I didn't want others to feel upset or uncomfortable because of my situation, so I continued to put the feelings and needs of everyone else before my own. So many people remarked on how brave I was and how they admired the way I was dealing with my illness. Many, many individuals also commented on how positive and happy I always was, but that's not how I really felt inside. Danny was the only person who really understood what was going on and how much being around other people took a toll on me, so he slowly began acting as a protective shell around me, shutting people out. In the presence of others, I always felt the need to perform at being happy and positive, because I never wanted anyone to feel bad for me, nor did I want them to worry. Eventually, this started to really drain me, and I wouldn't even answer the phone because I didn't want to talk about my illness. I didn't want anybody's advice on how to handle what was going on inside me, and I didn't want to repeatedly answer the endless questions that people who care tend to ask. I stopped going out and stayed in the safety of my own home, because apart from feeling unwell, I physically appeared very sick. My breathing was labored, my limbs were very, very thin, and I had difficulty holding my head up. The looks and comments I got because of this bothered me. I knew that people weren't staring at me out of contempt or displeasure, but rather out of curiosity and perhaps a sense of pity. When I caught them looking, they shifted their eyes away abruptly, and I sensed their discomfort. I recognized the emotion behind their expressions, as I'd often felt it myself when seeing someone who was very ill. They felt sorry for me. I soon came to accept that reaction as the norm from people who saw or interacted with me, and I felt sorry that my presence made others feel so uncomfortable. So at this point, I stopped going out in public altogether. Soon, I found myself locked in my own cage of fear and desperation, where my experience of life was getting smaller and smaller. Time slid by in a slippery descent. To me, anyone who didn't have cancer was lucky. I envied every healthy person I met. It didn't matter what their living conditions were. They were without this fiend that was relentlessly plundering my body, my mind, and my life. Each morning, I woke up with a glimmer of hope. Today may just be the day that things turn around. But each evening would end with the familiar heavy feeling, every night bringing a greater sense of defeat than the day before. Disillusioned, I started to question what I was fighting so hard to keep. What did it all mean, anyway? In my pain and fear, I could no longer see the purpose in continuing, and I felt myself getting tired. I was beginning to give up. I was getting ready to admit that I was beaten. By this time, I was going in and out of the hospital for blood transfusions and other treatments. When I was at home, I spent most of my days sleeping or resting. I couldn't go out or walk around for prolonged periods of time. Just half an hour of activity left me tired and out of breath. I was losing weight fast and perpetually running a low-grade fever. "Do you think my condition can still improve at this stage?" I asked my doctor one day, immediately after he'd finished conducting a routine body scan to assess my situation. He averted his eyes as he said, "I'll send the nurse in to help you get dressed." What he didn't tell me was that he wanted to talk to Danny in private. "There's little we can do now," the doctor told him once they were safely outside. He looked directly at my husband and continued, "She has about 3 months to live at best. The latest scans show that the tumors have grown and increased in number, and the cancer has spread quite aggressively throughout her lymphatic system. It's too late even for chemotherapy. Her body can't handle the toxicity at this stage. She's so weak that any treatment now will just weaken her further and bring her closer to death. I'm so sorry." Although Danny put on a brave front and didn't tell me what the doctor had said at the time, and he had shared it with me many months later, I could tell something wasn't right. At that point, he'd barely been going to work, but from the day of that doctor's visit, he stopped going in altogether. He seemed reluctant to ever leave my side. One day I asked him, "Am I going to die?" "We're all going to die sometime," he said. "I know that, silly," I countered. "I mean now, because of the cancer. What if I die?" "Then I'm going to come and get you and bring you back," he responded gently, stroking my head as I lay on the bed. This was about 6 weeks after the last meeting with the doctor. By now, breathing had become a labored task, and an oxygen tank was my permanent companion. I couldn't lie down, needing to be propped up at all times to keep from drowning in my own fluids. Every time I tried to lie flat, I started choking and had difficulty breathing, so changing my position in bed became an impossible task. My body broke out in lesions all over. So many toxins had invaded my system that my skin was forced to open up and release the poisons within. Many times I woke up in a heavy sweat, my clothes soaked through, night sweats being a common symptom of lymphoma. Often my skin itched all over, as though ants were crawling all over me. I recall one night when the itching was so strong that no matter how much I scratched myself, it wouldn't subside. Danny got ice cubes from the freezer and put them into Ziploc bags, and we rubbed these ice packs all over my legs, arms, and body in order to soothe my inflamed skin. It took a long, long time, but the itchiness finally subsided. Most of our nights were sleepless, and by this point, I was completely dependent on Danny to care for me. He anticipated my every need before it arose. He dressed my wounds and helped me wash my hair. Although I felt guilty about him having to spend his days caring for me in this way, I knew that he never, ever acted out of obligation, duty, or responsibility. Everything he did sprang from pure love for me. My digestive system eventually stopped absorbing nutrients from the food I was eating, so I became malnourished. Danny bought me my favorite chocolates, and my mother prepared some of my favorite foods to try and get me to eat, but I had no appetite. I wasn't absorbing whatever I did manage to choke down, and I watched my muscles disintegrate until I could no longer walk. My mobility then came in the form of a wheelchair. My body started to consume the protein from my own flesh to survive, until I looked like a poster child from a famine-struck nation. I became a skeleton of my old self, and my head felt like a 300-pound barbell that I could barely lift from the pillow. I was still going in and out of the hospital, but every time I was there, I wanted to leave as quickly as possible and be home. I felt those institutions were cold, clinical, and depressing, and they seemed to make me feel even sicker than I already was. So finally, we hired a nurse to stay with me during the day. Both my mother and my husband never left my side during those days, and Danny sat up with me through the night. He wanted to make sure that I continued to breathe and to be there just in case I was taking my last breath. Many nights I wasn't able to sleep for coughing, so I was always grateful for his comforting presence. But I was also acutely aware of his pain, and that made it so much harder for me to endure my situation. Even through all of this, I continued to put on a brave front and kept assuring everyone that I wasn't in pain. I told them that I was feeling fine, even though that was so far from the truth. At the same time, I was also aware of my mother's anguish. I knew that no mother should watch her child go before her, let alone witness her child's slow and painful disintegration. On the morning of February 1st, 2006, I was feeling more positive than usual. I actually started to notice things around me. The sky looked bluer than normal, and the world seemed like a beautiful place. Although still wheelchair-bound, my oxygen tank is my constant companion, I was wheeled home from the clinic with a feeling that it was okay to let go now, that everything was going to be fine. The world won't stop if I'm not in it. I have nothing to worry about. I don't understand why, but I'm feeling emotionally good, better than I felt in a long time, I recall thinking. My body ached and my breathing was difficult and labored, so I went to bed. Because I was in pain all over and couldn't sleep, the nurse administered morphine just before she left at the end of the day so that I could get some rest. But something was different. I could feel myself relaxing and letting go of the strong grip with which I'd been clinging to life. All that time, it was as though I'd been hanging from the edge of a cliff. I'd been fighting a losing battle, struggling to hold on. I was finally ready to let go of everything that I'd been gripping so tightly. I felt myself sink into a deep sleep. The following morning, February 2nd, I didn't open my eyes. Apparently, my face was grossly swollen. So were my arms, legs, hands, and feet. Danny took one look at me and called a doctor, who directed him to rush me to the hospital. I was about to end my battle with cancer.